The first of the three sections our lesson is divided into today is called Put Aside Your Pride, and it covers verses 1 through 4. Verses 1 and 2 read, Now Jacob looked up and saw Esau coming toward him with 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two slave women. He put the slaves and their children first, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. The Hebrew text suggests that Esau's throng was advancing rapidly. As the distance between the two brothers closed, Jacob acted to protect his family. Esau was coming toward him with 400 men. Jacob could only assume that his brother meant to harm him and that his gifts mentioned in Genesis 32:13-21 in last week's lesson had failed to soften the brother's anger. Jacob feared what he saw coming. Jacob reorganized the family formation and its order of march. Earlier, Genesis 32:7-8 told us that he had split the family and livestock into two camps, hoping that if Esau attacked one camp, the other might escape. Now he divided his family into three smaller groups. Interestingly, the new order of the groups reflected Jacob's favoritism. At the front, he placed Bilhah and Zilpah with their four sons. The two are not named in the text, but are designated by their status as slaves. The term points out their subordinate marital status as well as their servitude. The second group included Leah, her six sons, and one daughter. It was the largest group. Last was Rachel and Joseph. No doubt, Jacob hoped his brother's bloodlust, thought to exist, would be satisfied by the time he reached a lone woman and her only child. Clearly, he wished to save the wife he loved most. In these verses, Joseph is the only son mentioned by name. This favoritism fostered tension among the other sons that would have monumental consequences in later years. Verses 3 and 4 read, He himself, and now we're talking about Jacob, went on ahead and bowed to the ground seven times until he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet him, hugged him, and kissed him. Then they wept. Despite his fear, Jacob put himself in front of the column. All of his preparations reveal the magnitude of weight his earlier behavior had now put upon his conscience. He was ready to reap the consequences of that conduct. Bowing to the ground seven times was an ancient protocol for approaching a king. Jacob had crossed the Jabbok River the previous day. From that moment until now, he had traveled due south directly toward the region where Esau lived. The gesture of bowing signified Jacob's recognition that his brother controlled the area southeast and south of the Dead Sea. Moreover, it was an expression of humility, indisputable evidence of the transformation of Jacob's character. The once arrogant trickster now put aside his pride and paid homage to his brother. Esau's response to his estranged brother was totally unexpected. When they came face to face, Esau embraced Jacob in a gesture of acceptance. Verse 4 uses five verbs in rapid succession to convey the swiftness with which this surprising gesture occurred. The sheer size of the force accompanying Esau suggested sinister purposes. The speed at which they were approaching further indicated evil intent. Then Esau saw his brother for the first time in 20 years. Jacob voluntarily bowed before Esau. Suddenly, Esau bolted from his group of servants and ran ahead. The reunion of the two brothers exploded, not in violence, but in emotion. Esau hugged Jacob. He threw his arms around Jacob. Literally, the text says, he fell around his neck. This verbiage indicates unrestrained sentiment rather than a customary greeting hug. Finally, he kissed him. Obviously, Esau had experienced his own transformation. The Bible does not tell us when or how this transformation occurred, but Esau's astonishing change is not possible without it. Jacob's misdeeds had been forgiven and forgotten. Esau only saw a beloved brother. At that moment, Esau had a dominant military force, but he refused to use it. True transformation is seen in approaching others with humility. We must all keep an open, level head, clear mind about where we stand with others. Our preconceived notions or opinions about other people's anticipated behavior could cloud or upset an otherwise calm situation. Be genuine is our next section, and it covers verses 5 through 11. Verse 5 reads, "When Esau looked up and saw the women and children, he asked, 'Who are these with you?' He, Jacob, answered, 'The children God has graciously given your servant.'" Jacob had been aware of the size and composition of Esau's party. Their rapid movement likely raised dust clouds along the road they were traveling. In contrast, the number of servants accompanying Jacob is not stated, but it was certainly far less than 400. Moreover, they were scattered with the flocks, accompanying the group, rather than consolidated like a single fighting force might be. The only action Jacob is known to have taken was to reorganize his family's travel groups. Otherwise, his followers remained stationary. Hence, no dust clouds would have drawn attention to them. More importantly, Esau's attention was focused on the lone figure in front of the group. Eventually, as the tears subsided, Esau looked over Jacob's shoulder and saw the women and children standing apprehensively behind Jacob. He would have seen 4 adult women, 12 children. Reuben, the oldest, was not yet 13, and Joseph, the youngest, was likely no more than a toddler. Esau asked, "Who are these with you?" Jacob identified the children as his offspring, but made no mention of their mothers. He probably assumed that Esau would realize they were his wives. In Genesis 26:34 and in 28:8-9, we learn that Esau himself had 3 wives. Jacob told Esau that God had graciously given the children to him. The statement had dual implications. First, it is a general biblical principle from Psalms 127:3, and Jacob was acknowledging that children are a gift from God. Second, the statement was alluding to God's promise. God promised several places in Genesis to give Abraham, Isaac, and himself many children. Jacob was accepting his role in the greater promise stated in Genesis 12:1-3. Both ideas reflected his newfound faith in the God of his father and his grandfather. Jacob's answer at the end of verse 5, when he said, "Your servant," continued to show his deference to Esau. The basic sense of the Hebrew term is slave. It can also refer to a vassal of a king. Here it is the latter sense and was a verbal expression equivalent to bowing 7 times mentioned earlier in the lesson. Verses 6 and 7 read, "Then the slaves and their children approached him," that's Esau, "and bowed down. Leah and her children also approached and bowed down. And then Joseph and Rachel approached and bowed down." In succession, the three groups walked up to the two brothers. First came the two slaves, or substitute wives, and their children. They bowed before Esau. Leah and her 7 children came next. They too bowed down in deference to the men. Behind them, of course, was Joseph and Rachel. The text does not indicate the number of times they bowed. It was sufficient to indicate submission and homage. Interestingly, in the Hebrew text of verse 6, the verb bowed down is feminine, whereas in verse 7, it's masculine. This grammatical distinction has nothing to do with gender. Rather, it is a linguistic construction that indicates the inferior status that the concubines have as slaves as opposed to the legitimate status Leah and Rachel had as wives. Only Rachel's son Joseph is named. The reason is twofold. First, it reflects his favored status in his father's eyes. Second, it prepares the readers then and us now for the prominent role he will play in the future narrative. Presumably, each family group slowly walked past the two brothers and, after bowing down, proceeded on down the road. Verses 8 and 9 are referring to the gifts Jacob prepared to give to Esau. They read, "So Esau said, What do you mean by this whole procession I met? To find favor with you, my lord, he, Jacob, answered. I have enough, my brother, Esau replied. Keep what you have. Although short in military capabilities, Jacob's caravan made an impressive spectacle. Esau inquired, What do you mean by this whole procession I met? We saw in Genesis 32, 13 through 20, part of last week's lesson, that the previous day Esau had met at least 9 separate flocks or herds of animals. There was a significant difference between the groups, and included goats, sheep, cattle, donkeys, and camels. Each herd was driven by one of Jacob's slaves. When the slaves encountered Esau, they reported to him that the animals in that herd were a gift from Jacob. Now 3 more groups from Jacob's family had passed him, each paying respect to Esau. Behind the family, the road was packed with more goats, sheep, cattle, donkeys, and camels. I thought as I typed all that, that would have made a real spectacle out on I-85, wouldn't it? Joseph sought Esau's favor. The Hebrew word used here in its original form is related to graciously given, used in verse 5. God had extended grace to Jacob and blessed him even though he didn't deserve it. Now Jacob was asking Esau to extend grace to him, even though Esau would have been justified in attacking him. The designation, my lord, at the end of verse 8, was the appropriate title for addressing a king. By using it, Jacob maintained the humility and esteem he had originally shown by bowing down to Esau and labeling himself as Esau's servant. Wealth, or lack of it, played a major role in the sibling rivalry that characterized Jacob and Esau's relationship. Their father, Isaac, was a very rich man. According to custom, the firstborn, Esau, should have inherited 2/3 of his assets, as well as leadership over the family. Jacob would have received only 1/3 of Isaac's possessions. But Jacob's scheming had reversed the inheritance so that he acquired both the 2/3 bequest as well as leadership over the family. Nicely enough, in the 2 decades since their separation, both brothers had prospered significantly. The gifts Jacob dispatched towards Esau were to placate his wrath. The gifts would have also demonstrated that Esau did not need to fear Jacob's plans, since he, Jacob, was affluent enough to give such lavish gifts. Esau reciprocated his brother's generosity by just saying, I have enough. Additionally, in his comment, Esau elevated Jacob's self-imposed vassal status to my brother. While both men were genuinely glad to see each other and were relieved by the other's conduct, a lifetime of mistrust is not easily reversed. Each wanted to trust the other, but each was treading lightly. Verses 10 and 11 read, But Jacob said, No, please, if I have found favor with you, take this gift from me. For indeed I have seen your face, and it is like seeing God's face since you have accepted me. Please take my presents that was brought for you, because God has been gracious to me, and I have everything I need. So Jacob urged him until he accepted. Esau's acceptance of the gifts would serve as a sign that he had received his young brother favorably. The incredible transformation by both brothers is apparent in the manner they conducted the discussion over the gifts. Greed and jealousy no longer characterized their objectives. Jacob was specific in attributing his prosperity to God's grace and not his own cleverness. In doing so, he removed any perception of arrogance which might have caused Esau to hesitate in accepting the gifts. Even so, Jacob had to be persistent in urging his brother to accept his generosity. Genuine reconciliation can only occur when both parties demonstrate proper attitudes and actions. Agree on limits is the last section of our lesson and covers verses 12 through 15. Verse 12 reads, Then Esau said, Let's move on and I'll go ahead of you. Apparently, Esau presumed that Jacob would be going south along the same road he would be traveling. This would have been logical as Jacob's movement during the preceding days corresponded to this. Additionally, their father, Isaac, was a nomadic herdsman. Jacob owned no pasture land in the area. His brother's reconciliation would allow Jacob to migrate to the territory controlled by Esau and pasture his flocks there. Even if Jacob decided to settle elsewhere, Esau would have anticipated Jacob's enjoying his hospitality. "Let's move on" conveys a sense of urgency, not only to travel, but to cultivate the newfound relationship. The projected travel route for both parties traversed dangerous territory. The territory north of Arnon was disputed territory controlled by the Amorites. South of Arnon, the land was isolated and hostile. Jacob's entourage was lightly defended and would have been a tempting target for any hostile inhabitants in the area. Esau, on the other hand, led a significant military formation. When he said, "I'll go ahead of you," he was offering Jacob a military escort for the protection of his family and his flocks. Verse 13 and 14 read, "Jacob replied, 'My Lord knows the children are weak, and I have nursing flocks and herds. If they are driven hard for one day, the whole herd will die. Let my Lord go ahead of me. I will continue on slowly, at a pace suited to the livestock and children, until I come to my Lord at Seir.'" Jacob recognized that a military march Esau and his group were used to differed dramatically from his family's migration. Soldiers were conditioned to a faster pace than women, children, and farm animals. His family and animals were already exhausted from a long, strenuous journey. Any attempt now to move them ahead at a rapid pace could end with catastrophic consequences. Jacob continued his politeness by calling Esau "my lord" and himself "Esau's servant." Then he proceeded to repeat his brother's words, but with very different implications. Esau's troops would move out first, but Jacob and his family and animals would follow at a more leisurely pace. "Until I come to my Lord at Seir," at the end of verse 14, is problematic. Seir was a mountain range that ran the entire length of biblical Edom. This was the territory where Esau lived. In fact, instead of going to Seir, Jacob would turn around and migrate north to Succoth, which we'll see in a minute. Some scholars have seen traces of Jacob's old duplicity or double-mindedness in the decision. He did tell Esau he would do one thing and then did another. However, it's more likely that after thinking about the situation, he realized the need to geographically separate himself and his entourage from his brother if he was to fulfill his role in God's plan. Verse 15 reads, "Esau said, 'Let me leave some of my people with you.' But he," Jacob, replied, "Why do that? Please indulge me, my lord." Once more, Esau offered assistance, but Jacob again declined. The two brothers agreed to part ways on good terms, knowing that God was gracious to both. The exchange between Jacob and Esau was very positive in tone and content. Our highlighted verses for this lesson end with verse 15. There, however, things are just left hanging. The last five verses of chapter 33 bring things to an orderly close in Jacob's life, and we need to take a look at them. The places mentioned in the next few verses are shown on the map on the inside back cover of your quarterly. As you read the verses in the quarterly, take a look at the map. It'll give you a better idea of what's happening. Verses 16 through 20 read, "So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went north to Succoth, where he built a shelter for himself and for his livestock." That's why the place is called Succoth. After Jacob came from Padan Aram, he arrived safely in Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver, he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, a plot of ground where he pitched his tent. There he set up an altar and called it El Eloi Israel. Here are a couple of comments on these verses. Succoth, mentioned in verse 17, means shelters. Haran, where Jacob met and married his two wives, is part of Padan Aram, and where his current journey originated. El Eloi Israel in verse 20 means God of Israel, or mighty is the God of Israel. When Jacob and Esau parted and Jacob settled in Succoth, he was east of the Jordan River and still outside of Canaan, the land promised to him by God. He eventually crossed the Jordan River and settled near Shechem on land purchased from a Canaanite. There was now considerable distance between him and his family and Esau and Esau's family. The great distance of separation would ensure no future repetitions of their earlier struggles. Conflicts can be minimized by creating wise safeguards. That's something we should all keep in mind. Let's close with a prayer. Lord, forgive our sins. Thank you for all the good things you do for us. Thank you for being there for us and being available for us to lean on. Help us to realize, Lord, you're always with us and to act like it. As we go through our lives, Lord, help us to seek to live peaceably with everyone we meet and to seek reconciliation with others when we need it. In Jesus' name I pray.